Thank you, Scott. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Kalk. It's approximately 10 minutes after 2 today, Wednesday, September 25th. We're here for a, I believe, an informal, informal on case number PU 13-332. Little background. In June of this year, MDU filed an application for advanced termination of prudence for the Lewis and Clark Station filterable particulate matter pollution control project. I'll let the company, I think, explain the project later on as we go through. But basically, the long and short of it is we're here today to listen to the company's thoughts on it. We had a notice out there. Anyone requesting a formal hearing had up until August 28th of this year to request that. No one has requested an informal hearing. And we're here today to hear the company's thoughts and proceed to a decision. So I don't have any additional opening comments. I would open up to my colleagues.
I have nothing else to add at this point.
I don't have anything to add either. I'll just look forward to hearing the company's information first.
Okay, the commissioners have identified themselves. If you just start down the line and identify who's at the table here and anybody else that should be identified on the telephone.
This is Brian Giggy with Montana Dakota Utilities.
Okay. Alan Welty, Montana Dakota Utilities.
Dan Kuntz, appearing for Montana Dakota Utilities.
Sarah Cardwell, PSC staff.
Okay, and who's taking the lead over there for the case?
Commissioners, we have a couple presentations by Mr. Welty and Mr. Giggy, but first I'd like just to make a few opening comments, kind of set the stage for this. Earlier this year, the company, Montana Dakota, filed its 2013 IRP, or Integrated Resource Plan, and that plan included analysis or recommendations of the resources needed to meet its future energy needs of its customers. The IRP included analysis regarding the continued operation of the Lewis and Clark Generating Station, which is located near Sidney, Montana. The reason it was included, that analysis, was because the plant needs to add a baghouse and other equipment to meet the requirements of the Mercury and Air Toxic Standards Rule, or MATS as it's called, to allow continued operation after 2015. And that presents an issue, first of all, because in order to install that equipment, it's going to cost approximately $27 million. And then the second piece, of course, is the uncertain future of what other regulations might be coming down and how that affects coal plants. And do you continue to invest in a relatively aging coal plant in light of all this uncertainty? But at the same time, the Lewis and Clark Station, as you'll hear, is an important generation resource for our company and our customers. It's located within the Bakken Energy Development, which, as the commission knows, is seeing exceeding growth in energy needs. But it also provides not only energy but voltage support for the electric system in that part of the state. The IRP analysis made a conservative assumption then, assuming that this plant were to operate with this new baghouse equipment for even just 5 years. Would this make sense? And then they compared that up against the cost of converting it to natural gas or other generation alternatives. In short, as Mr. Giggy will explain, it was determined that even if this plant operates for just 5 years with this baghouse, this is still the least cost alternative to what the other alternatives are out there. So in light of that, the company believes it's prudent to proceed with the installation of the baghouse and the other equipment and seeks your concurrence. Mr. Welty has a presentation first that will talk about the Lewis and Clark Station and the upgrades that are needed. Mr. Giggy will describe the modeling process that led to the conclusion that this is a least cost alternative for our generation needs. And then we also have available Andrea Stomberg, who submitted pre-file testimony in this proceeding but does not plan to make a presentation but is available to answer questions. On the phone, we have Mr. Ken Snell from Sergeant Lundy, who can talk about the control technology. And then we also have other resources available in the room for Montana Dakota if questions come up that these folks can't answer. So with that, I would turn it over to Mr. Welty.
Thank you, Dan, Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to tell you a little bit about Lewis and Clark Station and specifically the equipment that's proposed to comply with the MATS rule. In my presentation, I will briefly overview the Lewis and Clark Station, discuss the MATS rule, which requires the addition of the equipment contemplated in this matter, I will summarize the control technology evaluation that we undertook to determine what equipment was needed, talk a little bit about the cost and schedule for the project, and then give an update of the project since our filing. Just a little bit about Lewis and Clark Station. It's been in commercial operation since October of 1958. It is a single unit, 50 megawatt electric generating facility. It has a tangential fired pulverized coal type boiler. It is located near Sydney, Montana, and we have 29 active employees there. The primary fuel for the plant is lignite, which is received by truck from the Savage Mine, which is a little over 20 miles away. Wanted to tell you just a little bit about how the existing emissions controls are configured. For NOx control, we have low NOx burners with close coupled overfire air, multi-clone collectors, and a flooded disc wet scrubber is used for particulate matter and as well as for some SO2 removal. The plant currently uses calcium bromide, which is a fuel additive, along with activated carbon injection for mercury control.
Alan, just a little question for me, that 50 megawatts seems like a really small coal plant to build back when they built it. Was there just a concerted effort to build smaller generation then, or why wasn't I never heard of a plant being built this small for coal until I read through your filing.
Actually, I think it would not be uncommon to see coal plants in that vintage to be in that 50 to, say, a little over 100 megawatts.
But the same type of technology that you'd see for the most part in these larger plants is going to be, this is going to be the same kind of thing, just a smaller scale?
Yeah. With Lewis and Clark Station, it's a great plant in that it's a pulverized coal boiler technology, which is used on many of the larger plants that have been placed in service more recently.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Uh-huh. And I'll talk a little more about that. This is a great aerial view of the station. I just thought I'd point out a few things of interest here. The plant is adjacent to the Yellowstone River, so it receives its water for once-through cooling from the Yellowstone for the condensing of the steam from the steam turbine. The majority of the ash and scrubber wastes right now are handled in a wet condition, and those ponds that are primarily in the background of the picture here. And the other thing that's unique to this plant is that it has this flooded disc wet particulate scrubber. And so if you're ever in Sydney, Montana, year-round, you'll anticipate seeing water vapor coming from the stack. Unlike some plants that have dry technologies, you may not see anything coming out of the stack in the summer especially. So that's unique to the plant.
As long as you've got that picture up there
sure.
with the ponds. Have you had any trouble with those ponds? We're at Nehruk recently. There was some folks who don't really like coal talking very negatively about those ponds. So I'd be interested in your comments about any challenges you have with the ponds, that type of thing.
We have not had any specific violations or those types of things, or... Mm-hmm. I guess I would have to defer that question to maybe Abby, who's on the phone as well, if we need to. But no, not that I'm aware of any specific challenges to them. The bottom ash pond, which is the farthest one here, that was constructed, and maybe Andre can remember that date. It was that's not that old. It's a synthetic lined pond, newer technology for the design and construction of that.
Okay.
So.
Thanks.
Any other questions while I have the overview up here? Mm-hmm. One thing that I'll be mentioning later on is you can see there's two chimneys on this plant. The one without a plume coming from it is the original stack. That was used primarily before the addition of the wet flooded disc particulate scrubber, and that has been abandoned. Initially, it had a way to bypass. We had a way to bypass and still use that stack, but that has, for many years, has been abandoned. We will talk about this project needing to remove that chimney in order to optimize the construction of the bag house. So.
Do you, one more question on sure. that. Do you discharge hot water back into the river or not?
Yeah, the cooling for the steam condensing is once through, meaning you pull in cold water, heat it up a little bit, and discharge it under a permit. There's a small waste stream that's discharged as well, but separate from the closed cooling water.
Okay.
And do they fish there all winter because the water's warmer?
I don't know if I can answer that question. I know that there's fishing in that immediate area. I don't think it's as prevalent as what we would see at Heskett, like, for instance, at Heskett Station.
How big is the Heskett Station in megawatts?
It has a total of about 100 megawatts between the two units.
Okay.
And just for the history, Heskett Unit 1 was built first in about 1954. It went in service. Then Lewis and Clark in 58, and then we went to Unit 2 at Heskett in the early 60s. So that was the construction sequence.
Well, since you know this history so well, I wasn't going to ask because no one here probably could begin to remember it, but how big was the MDU plant that was in the city of Beulah that got decommissioned about 30 years ago?
We had that, the Beulah plant had multiple units. So the biggest unit, I believe, was about 7.5 megawatts, mm-hmm. and there was around a 2.5 and a 3.5 megawatt generator as well. There were five boilers, two boilers for the newer part of the station, and so it was quite a mixture of equipment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I was actually stationed there for a short while, so.
Don't date yourself.
Sure. Despite the comments that Dan made about the age and size of Lewis and Clark, we consider this is one of our most, one of our best resources. It's a low-cost baseload resource, and within Montana, Dakota's fleet, including Coyote Station and Big Stone, it provides 12% of our integrated system energy. These are 2012 numbers, about 9% of the required capacity credits. And of those of all of our coal plants, it has consistently ranked two or three as having the lowest average fuel costs, and three or four in the lowest total or average total station costs. And as Dan mentioned in his opening remarks, it also provides a very valuable reliability role in that region. It serves load and provides voltage support, and then provides support during critical transmission system outages.
Who's going to talk about when you looked at the other alternatives? Is that next?
That'll be Brian.
Okay.
Yes. So let's get to the talking about the MATS rule itself. This project is required to meet the Environmental Protection Agency's Mercury and Air Toxic Standard Rule, which is commonly referred to as MATS, and it is necessary to continue operating the Lewis and Clark Station in the future. The MATS rule regulates hazardous air pollutants and includes standards for mercury, non-mercury metals, and includes standards for acid gas emissions. For the non-mercury trace metals, the rule includes three alternative limits for compliance. They include filterable particulate matter. So these are limits that you can use to comply in three different ways. Filterable particulate matter, you can measure and monitor that. You can measure and comply using the measurement of the total of all of the non-mercury metals. Or you can comply on the individual non-mercury metal basis. And I hope you don't ask me what each of those are. But so, and then the rule also has, so there's some variety of ways to comply, and the rule also has, includes this acid gas emissions limits that are based on either HCl, hydrochloric acid, or there's a surrogate for to use SO2, a low limit of SO2 to show compliance. The rule was finalized on February 16th of 2012, and the compliance must be demonstrated by April 16th of 2015. The rule does provide the opportunity for the states, and in this case the Montana Department of Environmental Quality, to provide an additional year to install the equipment. Montana, Dakota will need to have that extension, and we have engaged in discussions with them and do not believe that that will be a problem getting that extension.
Alan, can you just kind of give me an armchair, how you're out there and you're looking, and maybe Brian will talk more about this, but you're looking at this plant with all these other federal regulations dropping in every day. How do you even begin to decide, okay, should we try to put something else in with this operation to meet another standard, or how do you integrate all these new federal rules coming into play or guidelines?
That's a great question. Certainly, as we'll talk about a little bit in the control evaluation, we looked beyond just the match rule to say, okay, what combination of controls could we leverage to be ready for a future standard? It's very difficult, however, to make, you know, to proceed with large costs that are for regulations that haven't been promulgated yet. So, but we definitely, as you will see further on in my presentation, and we have Ken Snell on the phone that can really probably speak to that some more, is we try to say, okay, if we use a dry technology, how does the waste stream affect the, like, for instance, the effluent guideline rules in the ash disposal? So we try to rein those all into the best solution that puts us in the best position.
Is there any other compliance deadlines that are around this plant that we should know about for other type of upgrades?
The only thing for certain, and Abby or someone else can step in on this, but the only thing for certain that we know will be that in about 2018, there will be another round of the regional haze reasonable progress goal evaluation. So at that point, there'll be another round of evaluating what additional controls could be put on there for the criteria pollutants like SO2, NOx, particulate. So that's the only one that I'm aware of that's been firmed up as a rule.
Go ahead and finish.
I was just going to say and I know you can't speak for the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, but in general, would you view their commission more like our commission, North Dakota, when they view lignite coal, or more like the Minnesota commission? I mean, to try to see where they're at in some of this stuff. I mean, when they're looking at these kind of plants, obviously you have to go in and get some cost recovery from Montana as well. I mean, do you anticipate any friction points between that commission that it wouldn't necessarily affect our decision, but it'd be nice to know what they're thinking, as best you can explain that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd be the best one to discuss that.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
I was going to ask about water. Are there some water regulations?
Yes.
Stream buffer and some.
Yeah, there's something called the effluent guideline rules that will be promulgated possibly in the future. We are, and I'll speak a little bit to that as we go through the technologies that we selected. If you get to the, first of all, our review of the rule as we think it'll be come out is that Lewis and Clark would not be affected dramatically by that. But however, you're in best shape to comply with that rule if you're handling your fly ash in a dry manner.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, we're proposing to use a baghouse, which that's its job, is to collect the ash in a dry manner so that we could put it in a silo and transport it without mixing it with water using the bottom ash pond as we are now.
So you'll be converting then to dry handling of
for
fly ash?
For the most ash streams, yes, the fly ash
the
will
fly
be.
Ash will be.
The bottom ash and possibly the economizer ash will still be sluiced and wet and be using the existing equipment in ponds. But so we're in the best position.
Go ahead. Alan, let me know, and I can talk a little bit about some of that, too.
Sure.
Go ahead, Abby.
Go ahead.
Okay. The the bottom ash, as the rule has been proposed, isn't going to lead to any other significant requirements for Lewis and Clark Station, so we wouldn't expect any cost to come from that compliance. Like Alan said, the baghouse provides the dry management of the fly ash, so that takes care of any potential changes in the final rule that may require something for Lewis and Clark. Right now, we don't think that those requirements are applicable to that small unit anyway. The 316B rule is, of course, expected to be final in next year. Thought it was going to be final this year. And with that compliance, we wouldn't see any potential requirements for fish impingement reductions at that plant until possibly 2020. And again, that cost was determined to be not significant as well if we had to make retrofits to the screens and so forth. And the coal ash rule is expected to be final as the effluent limits guidelines rule becomes final. The EPA is trying to coordinate the finalization of those two rules together because they have some kind of codependence, I guess, on how water is managed from ash. And so when that rule is final, we expect that there would be some maybe changes we would have to make to liners at our ash disposal site, implementing an engineered liner there, and then possibly relining the ponds that are at Lewis and Clark Station, but we don't think those would result in a significant capital expenditure that would help the magnitude you're talking about with the baghouse. I think that's about it.
While you're at it, Abby, what was that rule? Did you say 317?
316. Oh, 316B, which is a rule that requires plants with cooling, once through cooling water intakes, to do reviews of fish impingement, or in some cases, any organisms that get entrained within the cooling water system. It requires you to do a study to determine if there are any impacts from that, if you're killing fish at your screen. And then, if so, and if you're of a certain size, then you have to make a retrofit to the screens to manage the fish in a fish-friendly manner and return the fish to the river.
Okay.
In a nutshell.
Thank you.
So in order to determine how Lewis and Clark would comply with the MATS rule, an extensive control technology evaluation was conducted over several years. We did we performed diagnostic testing to determine our baseline emissions so that we could compare them to the emission limits that are in the MATS rule. And the bottom line from that, we found that the existing controls could not comply with any of those three alternatives for the non-mercury metal piece. So if we just step back, we're already complying with the mercury. We've determined we can comply with the mercury, and we're complying with the HCl, or the acid gas portion of the rule, but the non-mercury metals, we could not meet any of those three limits without the addition of new equipment. Sergeant Lundy was hired to perform and evaluate the strategies that we could use to meet the non-mercury metal emissions. And some of the strategies that were considered included fuel switching, modifications to our existing flooded disc wet scrubber, dry and wet electrostatic precipitators, adding a baghouse with modifications to the existing mist eliminators, which we'll talk about in a minute as the chosen technology, baghouse with dry sorbent injection, and a baghouse with dry flue gas desulfurization. The optimal option with the lowest cost for complying with the MATS rule for the filterable, and in this case, the non-mercury metals using the filterable particulate limit, is to install a baghouse, to modify the existing scrubber mist eliminators, to modify or replace the induced draft fan, to demolish the abandoned chimney for an optimal tie-in point, and to install new dry fly ash handling and storage silos.
Well, this, when you make these changes potentially, will you still be able to produce the 50 megawatts, or is this going to be a native load that is going to cut down what you can produce?
There will be a slight increase in the auxiliary power consumed by this, and that's why we showed that we would likely need to increase the size of the ID fan. Not completely sure yet the extent of that auxiliary load, but there will be some increase.
Thanks.
And I'll talk a little bit about that. That's all about pressure drop within the flue gas system. So this is a schematic of the showing the changes that will be made to the back-end equipment. The multi-clone dust collector will be removed. So you can see that's in the dashed line there. And it has about 4 inches of water pressure drop as the flue gas flows through that. It's replaced with the baghouse, which you can see has a +8. So there is, because you're pushing the flue gas through a constrained filter, you're going to have more losses and need more horsepower to draw the flue gas through. And then we mentioned the modification or replacement of the ID fan. Then the flue gas stream goes into the existing flooded disc wet scrubber, and then you can see the discharge of that goes to the stack, and that's where we add vapor horns and some mist elimination to ensure that the scrubber slurry does not contribute to particulate matter going out the top of the stack, if you will. So you're removing the fly ash in the baghouse, but we need to retain the flooded disc wet scrubber so that we continue to remove the SO2 that we have been removing previously and to meet the acid gas piece for the HCl. So we have to keep that in. So we take ash out, we spray slurry of lime back into there to control SO2, and then we put in the mist eliminators to make sure the very small droplets and so forth don't turn into mist that we collect as particulate and kind of undo what we did by taking the ash out in the baghouse. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. This is a unique situation anytime you're trying to retrofit one of these older plants. But
can you go through this little diagram and with your little pointer and talk about what comes out at each stage, like which the baghouse gets rid of?
Sure. So this just represents what I call the back end equipment. So the boiler would be over here where the coal is combusted. It goes through an economizer section that extracts heat from the flue gas and returns it into the feed water system, and it's just an efficiency measure for all power plants. This is the air heater. Air preheater. So the air needed for combustion exchanges the heat from the flue gas is exchanged to the air that's going to be used for combustion. So the hotter the air you can bring into your combustion process, that's another efficiency measure. So there's a little bit of fly ash that gets collected here. That's currently collected, and this stream from here will be combined with the ash that will come out of the baghouse into the new dry system. So In the existing configuration, the flue gas would have went to this multi-clone. It's really basically a very efficient, very inefficient collector of fly ash. It's more collects larger particles of ash, so it didn't make sense to keep that in operation. So with the new configuration, we put in a bag house. The flue gas basically goes into a vessel that has multiple chambers with hundreds of bags, in this case made out of either cloth or a fiberglass product. The flue gas goes through from the outside of the bag. The particles are captured on the face of the bag. The clean gas goes out the top and moves on to the ID fan. In this case, the ash is collected on the bag, and then there's a system that pulses the bag or puffs it to allow the ash to fall down into hoppers. And then, so the bulk of the fly ash at Lewis and Clark will now be collected in hoppers here, sent to a silo on a dry basis, and then it'll be unloaded into trucks and hauled directly to the ash disposal site instead of mixed with water as we are now. So clean flue gas from the baghouse to the ID fan maybe needs a little more horsepower to overcome the pressure drop through here. Then we go into the scrubber. This particular scrubber, the way we expose the flue gas to the we expose the flue gas to a very small, very confined stream of in the case now with ash and lime that allows the SO2 reactions to occur and for it to be collected from the flue gas before it goes out the stack. The difference in the operation here will be the coal ash right now has alkalinity and calcium in it that allows for the reactions to remove SO2, and we only supplement a little bit of lime with that right now. In the new system, because you remove all the ash before it gets here, we'll have to add a lot more lime into this vessel to continue to remove that amount of SO2.
So how is it, it is collected by the chemicals, and then what happens to the SO2?
It ends up as a liquid waste in the bottom of the vessel here and is transferred to ponds, settled, and eventually from those ponds it's removed as sludge, dewatered, and then hauled to the ash disposal site.
Keep it out of the air.
Absolutely, yep. Yes. So flue gas is cleaned here, and the reactions occur in the, and basically, I should have said that scrubber waste comes really out of this vessel, and then is pumped to the, and then right now, if this kind of looks like the whole thing is a stack, but the way it's designed. In its existing form is there's some restrictions and changes in gas flow directions to try to eliminate some mist as it's configured now before it would go out the top of the stack. We feel that's probably not going to be adequate. So then these things we'll be adding will be, they're called horns, vapor horns. They'll try to redirect the flue gas to more of a uniform distribution across these mist eliminator stages. And they're basically like chevrons. You've seen or heard about maybe cooling towers that have really congested, tight pack or fill, so the air, or in this case the flue gas, has to travel through a treacherous path, and then it has water sprayed to try to capture or remove that mist and any particles.
What's in the mist at that point that we don't like?
There could be a very small amount of ash that gets through the baghouse, but the main thing will be the scrubber slurry, which will be basically water and what's in it, and then lime that's added for the SO2 reactions. How am I doing, Ken? Are you awake?
I am awake, and I think you're doing good.
Okay, thanks. I want to just make sure he's still there. And then finally...
On TV also, just to let you know.
Okay. And then finally, the remaining flue gas travels out the stack. We're needing to put some enclosures up here to allow our people to perform stack testing throughout the year. Right now, we try to limit those activities to the summer months. In the MATS rule, there's options to show compliance using quarterly testing. And this is all exposed. I could have pointed that out on the previous slide, but it's really cold up there. So we're going to put some enclosures up there
You were just trying to make it look like the space needle.
It looks like a donut up there. Interestingly enough, you have to be concerned about the aerodynamics, so whatever you put up on a chimney as well, so you don't start it to vibrate or something like that. I hope that kind of answers
great.
Your question.
Thank you.
This is a this is a 3D view from the design model, and I just wanted to show how you have to arrange or pack that new equipment into the existing site. So this is the boiler here. The flue gas right now comes from the air heater into the dust collector, and then you can't see it, but anyhow, there's an existing ID fan, a crossover pipe into that scrubber that I talked about, and then out the stack. So we'll grab the flue gas here, send it into the new filter bag house here. Flue gas will come out of there into the newer revamped ID fan, and then follow the same path out the stack, except within this lower section we would add those mist eliminators. This one here is the new fly ash storage silo, and it'll need some blowers and other equipment to produce the negative pressure to draw the ash out of the silos and so forth. And then there will be some power distribution power those electrically power the new equipment. Any questions on that one? So the conceptual project cost estimate, as Dan mentioned, is $27.7 million. This is plus or minus 20% estimate, and it includes administrative costs and AFUDC. I thought I'd put a few of the most current milestones for the project here. So these are when things will be completed. The preliminary engineering and equipment procurement packages be completed by February of 14. The detailed engineering will be substantially completed by October of 2014. The equipment and construction contract awards are expected to be done by December of 14. And then the civil construction is one of the critical items with this. We're hoping to have that ready to go and be completed before the winter of 2014 and 2015. General construction will occur throughout that period with a tie-in outage from about October through December of 2015. And then we're hoping to have commercial operation no later than about January of 2016. And from my previous slide, if we would have to have it in compliance by April of 2016 if we get that one-year extension. Any questions on that one?
At this point, is 20% one way or the other, is that a normal range? Or it seems like a pretty large range.
Yeah, that's not uncommon for the first cut of a control technology evaluation. In this case, my opinion would be that because the way the rule was promulgated and so forth, we had a very tight timeline to do a bunch of testing and try to figure out what we're going to do to comply. Given more time, you can always refine those numbers. But we are working on that right now.
But the follow-up to that would be your next closest alternative. If you go on the high side of this estimate, are you close to the next closest alternative for cost?
Not really, because most of the other alternatives that we looked at involved adding additional controls, like for SO2, more SO2 removal. So, okay.
So even at the high end, this is still the best deal you got.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And just a little bit of an update on the project. So we've engaged Sergeant Lundy to be our engineer for the design of the project. They are currently reviewing the design specifications and drawings. We had a site visit last week. That was to gather information so that we could advance from the preliminary design to more of detail. And then one thing I wanted to point out, that a few items I wanted to point out that may have potential impact to the project, mainly revolve around the operation of that existing flooded disc wet scrubber. So as I talked to you about on a previous slide, we're moving from using a combination of ash and lime to remove the SO2. We have to consider the water balance and material balances now that we'll be using primarily lime, and the effects of scaling or buildup on the different vessels. So just wanted to point out that is one piece that will be continuing to evolve, that has some needs some definition in regard to determining all of those streams, the water, the lime, and so forth.
Do you add the lime at the end, or is it added to the coal?
The lime is mixed with water and added at the end as a slurry in that flooded disc scrubber area. So, and then there'll be new things we have to do for waste disposal, as far as instead of using the ponds, we have to arrange for trucks to take it to our disposal site and so forth. That concludes my slides. I'd be glad to take any other questions you have.
The only question, just I'm not sure who's the best person, but tell me how the PSC granting this advanced termination of prudence is going to benefit the ratepayer.
I can take a swing at it. It'll allow us to keep one of our very lowest cost facilities in service for a longer period of time.
But if we don't grant the ADP, you still could make the decision to do it. We're not holding you up from the decision. What about the ADP makes it we should approve it now to benefit the consumer? Rate cases where we'll flush out the cost, but why do you need an ADP? Yeah. Why don't you just do it?
Mr. Commissioner, I think it gets back to the risk tolerance that this, someone might question the wisdom of putting this kind of money into a smaller coal plant. And we want to make sure that the commission is comfortable with what we're doing. I mean, that's part of the reason why we file an IRP, go through that analysis. If the commission has concerns about what we're doing and wants us to do something different, we want to find out about it now. Not 3 years from now when we have to come in for a rate case to recover these particular costs or through a tracker mechanism or something like that. It's the idea so that we're on the same page. If the commission's got problems with what we're planning to do on these significant problems, we want to know about it on the front end. And I think if you were in our shoes, you'd say the same thing. That if your primary regulator has got problems with what you're doing, we want to give you that opportunity to voice those concerns now. If you want us to go back and take another look, you think we should be doing something else, then I think it's, I don't know if partnership's the right term, but at least so that we're on the same page as we march forward in terms of how we're going to serve our customers.
Sure. I just wanted to get your answer on the record.
Okay.
But the next piece, though, is we're only part of this. How do you get that same reassurance from a Montana commission? Do they have similar proceedings or not?
They do not, as far as I understand, but understand that approximately two-thirds of our electric load is North Dakota. I mean, so that's a major, major piece of what we're doing here is going to affect North Dakota ratepayers.
This commission in the past has given out ADPs, and companies have chosen not to follow through, even though we said it was a good idea. So what kind of assurances would we have that if this commission does say it's a good idea, that you follow through with what you've told us you're going to do?
Well, we would follow through unless if something changed, that we would come back and then ask you, to take another, if we took another look at this, we would come back to you and say, hey, and I think I know what you're referring to, things change.
You would do that before you make the decision, since you're the project lead, actually the only person
right.
in this project.
We, you know, if something changed along the line, for example, you know, I think we've pretty well convinced, again, within this time, 5-year time frame, that we've got a pretty good handle on what the environmental regulations would be that would affect this to the point where it would allow us to continue to operate for at least 5 years. Well, if we woke up tomorrow and there was some new statute law was passed or something like that that made us change that, before we spent any more, we would come back to you if we decided that, you know, this doesn't, you know, the assumptions that we used have changed dramatically, that we need to take another look at.
And that's the point, speaking for myself, is that as this thing unfolds with all the pending regulation rules, if somewhere along the line there's an opportunity, we bring it back so we can all include that opportunity. So,
thank you. Okay. Yeah, thank I think you. That would be the intent. Again, to keep the lines of communication open, let you know what we're doing, what we're seeing, and, you know, again, hopefully have an opportunity for you to voice concerns and ask questions along the way.
Thank you, sir.
At that, with that, we'd ask the Commission's indulgence for Mr. Giggy's presentation.
Is that like Giggy Watt? Is that what that's like?
No, just Giggy.
That should be your new nickname.
Yeah.
Giggy Watt. It just stuck now, so too.
Yeah. And every time I see you, you're going to quit calling me that.
Yes, he will.
Yeah.
So will we.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to be going over kind of the resource expansion modeling that we used for this filing, plus it was actually used in our integrated resource plan that we filed here in July 1st of this year. The model that we use at MDU is an electric generation expansion analysis system, which is a GS. That was a model developed by EPRI. It's been used by MDU for over 25 years now and was also kind of developed by one of the employees that just retired recently in the beginning of the software. So as I mentioned earlier, it's the same model that was used in the integrated resource plan that was just filed on July 1st. The forecast that was used in the model was Montana Dakota's 2013-32 load forecast for demand and energy. That load forecast is kind of the main driver for the model. It shows what our capacity energy needs that we need to meet in that 20-year period. The model solves for the 20 years and then has an extension of 30 years to use up any capital for new units that would be added in during that 20 period. Now, just kind of some of the inputs that are into the model. The first would be our existing generating resources. This includes O&M cost, the generator characteristics, maintenance schedules for all of our existing units. We have the coal, which represents about 58% of our capacity credits in 2013. Natural gas fired units and our diesel engines contain about 17% of our capacity credit that we need to meet. Then for renewables, we have the waste heat unit in Glen Allen and then our 50 megawatts of wind. This represents about 2% of our capacity credit. And then the last one is just a capacity purchase contract that we have with We Energies, and that's represents about 20% of our capacity credit.
Brian, just a quick question on that. The waste heat from Glen Allen, I've been out there, that's a good setup. But is there other opportunities to use waste heat on that pipeline? I mean, how do you look at something like that?
I would say Ellen might be able to answer that better than I can.
I don't want to derail us too far, but that's it.
On the northern border pipeline, there probably are not opportunities because I think there's maybe 12 of those spread out across
the... Okay, so that's saturated. And then the diesel engines, I hadn't heard that before at that level. Where are those at in your
that
system?
Would be like the 3-2 megawatts that we have, portable diesel generators.
So you consider that as, I guess it's a resource mix.
Yeah, we actually can get capacity credits for them in MISO.
Okay.
All right. Those are just trailer-mounted units that we can move around.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, it doesn't count as much, but we do get about 2 megawatts for each unit. So, and then I guess our next one would be the committed generating resources that are in the model. You'll see the Big Stone AQCS was in 2015. The way it's modeled is the unit as it stands now is retired in the model in 2014. So then it had that option of picking it in 2015. Being as we've already went forward with it, it's committed into the resource plan now. And then the other one is Heskett Unit 3 is also in the model as a committed resource coming online in 2015. And that would be to meet our 2015-16 planning year in MISO, being that We Energy contract expires at May 31 of 2015. So, and then the next one would be the MISO Energy market purchases. The model has it built in, or it's a resource. There's two resources for it put in. There's 30 megawatts each for on-peak and off-peak. So the model can use that energy instead of, say, dispatching the turbine if the price is right. So
how do you, if you can, the resources that Basin Electric may have or may not have, can you include that anywhere in here? And if Southwest Power Pool ends up serving North Dakota, will you be able to reach into those markets too?
I mean, we can purchase capacity through MISO, through their annual auction. That is an option too.
Okay. I'm just thinking down the road a little bit. So that's not off the chart. You can do those things if there's a mutual agreements on it.
Yeah, in some cases it would require rates to drive in or drive out, if you will, I believe so, depending on.
Just Dorsey's educated
yeah.
me many
yeah,
that's
times.
A, the seams a Darcy question if we really want.
Okay, no, I don't want to derail it that much. Oh, no offense, Dorsey. All right, thank you.
All right, and then the last one would be the demand response programs. This counts for about 3% of the capacity credit in 2013. It has the commercial and industrial demand response, which was our external one. It had 5 megawatts in 2013, going up to 10 megawatts in 2014. And then the last one was just our interruptible tariff service that MDU has, and that had about 11.8 megawatts in 2013, going up to 13 megawatts in 2014. And this is kind of an overview of kind of the loading capability, as you would say. It shows what resources we have, what the demand forecast that we have to meet, and then it shows how much surplus and deficit we have. So starting on the left, you got the year, and then the next one would be your existing and committed generation resources, our planning, our credits. So that shows all of our existing and all of our committed resources. The second one is that We Energy's contract that expires May 31st of 2015. So it's only in 2014 because MISO's planning year starts June 1st of every year and goes to May 31st of the following year. The third column there is total zonal resource credits. This would be with the purchase contract and our existing committed resources. Those resource credits are calculated in MISO by the units. Each unit tests every year. Each unit has a forced outage rate. They take that forced outage rate times that generation value, and that's what you get for a credit within MISO. The next is our 50-50 coincident summer peak. This is our load forecast, demand forecast, with a 90% coincident factor. Being MISO is so large, we don't peak at the same time as MISO does. So that's why they went to this coincident factor instead of everybody having to meet their 50-50 forecast. The next is planning reserve margin requirement. This adds in 6.2% planning reserve margin that is calculated annually by MISO. And then the last column there just kind of shows what surplus and deficit we have for capacity credits with.
Can you correlate capacity credits to what the megawatts that customers need? So do I read this in 2026, we need 158 more megawatts of power? Or am I must be reading that incorrectly.
In 2026. Wow. Yeah.
Those are megawatts? The credits are direct to megawatts?
No, not directly. They're each unit tests, like I said, every year.
You're short of power.
Yeah. I guess I'll go back a little bit. That 90% coincident factor is higher than what we actually have to meet in MISO right now.
Okay.
Right now, we only have to meet about 80% coincident factor, but for planning purposes, we did do 90% just in case with Entergy joining and planning reserve margins constantly changing yearly. We just planned for that little extra.
So you're making your case that you really need this 50-megawatt plant, but it also is a concern of maybe you should go build some more stuff.
It's possible, but once I get into the results, I'll actually...
Okay.
One of the sensitivities we did run was with what currently, that 80% that we had to meet. So
can you speak... This peak, the middle column, coincident summer peak demand with MISO. What is that?
It is MDU's forecast. We forecast a 50-50, kind of our base forecast. Then we take that 90% coincident factor, mm-hmm. and so that reduces it down from what our forecasted from MDU was.
And so that's what you have to be prepared, plus the planning reserve, that's what you have to be prepared to.
Yep, the planning reserve margin requirement is what we have to.
But both of those are smaller than what you actually realized, right, according to the bullets on the right in 2012.
That one,
so
that 573 would be what MDU peaked. That would be a non-coincident peak.
Okay. So you don't have to prepare for that?
No, not anymore.
Okay.
All right, now I'll get into some of the supply, some more of the supply side resources.
What's it?
We got the potential new resources that were included into the model. They all included capital, O&M, and operating characteristics for each of those plants. Natural gas, there was 8 different options that were included into the model. There was 3 simple cycles, 3 combined cycle, and 2 internal combustion engine options. Coal, there was with and without carbon capture included in the model. Wind at 20 and 50 megawatts. There was 3 different types of solar that were included. Biomass, geothermal, and then there was 4 Lewis and Clark options. One was with the baghouse option that Alan's referenced earlier, and then 3 natural gas options were included in the model.
Do you have what number of CO2 recovery that you put in your carbon capture method? Like the number, because the president just announced some new numbers, and I was just curious what modeling number you use and then how much that drives up the cost if you have a percentage. That's a pretty detailed question, but.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess I don't have that off the top of my head. Or
it'd be nice to just know for some point in time.
Each of the units that we provide for selection in the model, I believe we provided the number of tons that would be produced for each of those types of units. And then Brian will talk about how we applied to account for greenhouse gases. We applied a tax to those the CO2 produced from each
$30 a ton or whatever it might
be. And he will be talking about that.
Okay, but, all right. Do you have a rule of thumb that you're using that $20 a ton equals roughly this much increase in cost?
I do not have a rule of thumb, but I could go back to your original question in regard to, just to give you an idea, I believe some of the numbers that are being proposed in the new rule would be in the around 1,000 actually I'll look at a graph I have to your point. The one thing I will say is our quick look at that based on some of the analysis we have in here is that even for simple cycle combustion turbines, to meet the new, the only way that some of them can even meet the new rule would be if they run it full, wide open, at their best efficiency point. So it's problematic for new units.
Okay, thank you.
All right, then I guess the next one would be our modeled potential unit retirements. The first one you'll see here is Heskett 1 at the end of 2019. This was just kind of a modeling purpose we did this. It was assuming that, as we talked earlier, that possible EPA rules could come out in that 2020 period that would cause Heskett 1 to either need additional emission controls or have to shut down. But, however, at this time, there's actual no plans of retiring Heskett 1. It was only done to model the potential to add something bigger instead of continually adding smaller gas turbines every few years.
But when you say there's no plans to retire Unit 1, are there any plans to prevent having to retire Unit 1?
At this time, we don't have anything.
So a project like we're doing, like we're discussing here at Sydney, is not being proposed for Unit 1 or for Heskett?
In regards to MATS compliance,
yes.
The Heskett units will be able to comply with the MATS rules with very little or no changes at all.
And then the next one is just our existing wind would be retired at the end of their 20-year life. This was just done so that at the end of the 20 years, roughly before the end of the 20 years, the model would have to pick something to replace that. Otherwise, it would run for 50-some years, and that's not really logical for it to run that long without any kind of extra capital put into the project. Now I'll just get into some of the options for Lewis and Clark. As I said with the Big Stone unit, Lewis and Clark was planned to retire at the end of 2014 as it's currently configured. So then the options, the four options after that were to either convert it, three of the options were to convert it to natural gas, and then the fourth one was the Lewis and Clark baghouse option. Which you can see the cost was around that $27 million, and then additional fixed and variable O&M costs for those upgrades. And then kind of as Dan started out with, we had that conservative five-year life modeled just so that we would be able to show it as a least cost resource. But then it would be forced to retire at the end of 2019. Kind of the same thing with Heskett 1. This was just kind of modeled for purposes for EPA rules that could potentially be come in place in that 2020 time frame. And now I'll just kind of get into some of the results from the modeling. The first case, which is the optimal or least cost resource plan. As I mentioned before, this was the same as what our IRP had, as this filing did. It was to install the Lewis and Clark baghouse project in 2015, look to 50 to 100 megawatts of wind purchase power agreement in 2015, and also add in roughly 110 megawatts of internal combustion engines in that 2015 to 2017 timeframe.
What do you mean by that? I'm trying to visualize that generation you're talking, internal combustion engine, which is generators?
Yeah, they're fired on natural gas. I'm sure Alan could give a little more detail on them.
These would be large engines tied to generators, basically commonly used in ships and things like that, where they're just very large, very efficient.
How are these different than... Okay, Cass County Electric's got a robust system of generators that the new air quality rules are giving them fits over there because they can't run their generators hardly at all, and that was part of their plan. Are these different emissions or is it you're going to be earning them less so you're exempt?
No, the IC engines that are contemplated as alternatives in here would have, for instance, emissions controls included with them, and they would be very large and very efficient. So unlike, say, we have these 2-megawatt portables, or I don't know how big the ones you're referring to are, they generally didn't come with emissions controls on them, and that's in order for them to continue to operate them for more than a certain amount of time. My understanding is they, depending on their vintage and so forth, they may have to have, like, for instance, NOx controls added to them. The ones that we gave as alternatives for the model in this case, the cost for NOx and CO control and so forth would have been included in.
Is there somewhere I can go to look at one of these on the World Wide Web? I mean, I can't even visualize this. A big big semi with the generator in the back?
No, they would be fixed generators. And, you could.
This would be something we would cite then if it's fixed.
Yes.
Okay, we'll cross that bridge when we come to the internal. So is it gas? So why wouldn't it be considered a gas peaker if it's internal combustion? I'm just trying to clear the nomenclature. Okay.
Yeah, it's using cylinders like a internal combustion engine as opposed to a jet engine, if you will.
Julie's point, they're just alternatives. All right.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Yeah, this is always.
But you want our feedback, the things that we'd like or don't like.
Maybe a quick. Alan, what would be the difference between one of these and Heskett 3?
Exactly. The exactly what I just said. The Heskett 3, the prime mover is some similar to like a jet engine. It has a compressor section. It compresses air, combines it with fuel, and then the exhaust. Whereas the other one is truly an engine that you, a large internal combustion engine, bigger, you know, bigger than a truck, of course. These are the best example I can give to you is some of this size would be used to drive a power plant on a ship.
Okay. All right. Well, if you bring one of those back as an ADP, have some more information.
If you really, if you really are interested in seeing them, the one of the major companies that supply these is called Wärtsilä.
Okay. Thank you.
And you'll find that in some of the information I gave you.
And then the next one would be potential partnering for 200 megawatts of a large combined cycle unit in 2020. And the last one was just a 20 megawatts of self-built wind in 2032, which was basically kind of replacing some of the ones that we already retired. And then next, I'll just kind of go into some of the sensitivities that we ran. This slide here shows the first column there, the base case, Lewis and Clark retired at the end of 2014. This is basically showing if Lewis and Clark retired, the model selected 4 of those internal combustion engines to replace Lewis and Clark of 146 megawatts. Then additional natural gas and wind in the later years. The middle column is the same that was on that previous slide, same resources that were added in. And then the far right case, this is the Lewis and Clark gas option, which was the cheapest gas option out of the 3 of them. So it would run on gas. It was modeled to be a 10% capacity factor for the first 5 years to provide support in the Bakken area, kind of what we've mentioned before. And then the bottom row there shows the net present value between each of the plans in millions of dollars. So as you can see, the optimal resource case with the Lewis and Clark baghouse was the cheapest option, and the next cheapest option would have been retiring Lewis and Clark instead of converting it to natural gas.
So this shows your optimal resource case in the middle.
Yep.
Out to, and that's addressing your projections through 2021?
It would actually be out to 2032.
Oh, okay. And that takes into account all your load growth out west?
Yep.
Projected load growth?
Yep, and all throughout our footprint, yep.
Okay.
Yep. And then the net present value includes all capital cost and production cost, fuel and O&M cost for all of the units and all the new units that are added into the model.
Does this assume that this would retire in 5 years or not, that the Lewis and Clark would retire in 5 years?
Yep, but the optimal resource case, yep, Lewis and Clark and Heskett 1 would both be retiring after that 5 years.
So this does take into account then some of the proposed additional regulations on coal.
Not the optimal resource. We did do additional sensitivity analysis with a carbon tax.
Okay.
Going into effect in 2020.
And that's included here, or that's in a different one?
That's a different sensitivity,
but this
yep.
Is still...
This was just kind of the base case. It didn't okay. include any other environmental additions.
All right.
If I could add to the answer for your question, it's conservative in that we chose to allow those units to be retired at that time frame, assuming that something was going to overcome them as far as an environmental rule goes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And kind of an addition to that, if we're able to run that plant longer with the bag house beyond the 5 years, that makes the optimum case even more compelling.
Yes.
It's just getting us a few more of the sensitivities that were ran on the optimal resource case. It's included here in the first column again. And then the other two ones with the low natural gas, which is taking it $1 lower than the base case, a decatherm. And then the high natural gas case taking it up to $3 a decatherm from the base case. And the price in 2013 in the model was at $3.51 a decatherm.
And the key here, Brian, is it's still picking the Lewis and Clark baghouse in all of those scenarios?
Yep, even with that low natural gas, it's still picking that over the natural gas option of Lewis and Clark.
Why is it doesn't show cheaper, low natural gas, right? 3.5 versus 3.2? Or am I reading it wrong?
The lower NPV value means it's a lower cost.
It so means your gas units will run cheaper because there's a lower fuel cost, so yep. That means your combined cost of running all your generation units will go down.
Right.
But it's still saying that even with that, it's saying you should still install the Lewis and Clark baghouse as an optimal resource under even with those lower gas prices.
But it's not cheaper than that. The Lewis and Clark is not a less expensive option.
It's still running the Lewis and Clark baghouse as a generation option. It's just that now you're also running gas units in conjunction okay. with it. Now you've reduced the cost of your gas units, which brings your total cost down. But your Lewis and Clark with the baghouse is still one of your least cost generation options within that mix.
I see. Yep.
It's not saying forget the baghouse,
yeah.
Go out and build another simple cycle turbine or something.
Just changing the other factors around it.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a sensitivity.
Yes.
Yep. Dan, I've got to ask you a question. You know, this is a good work series, a good informal. It's taken a while, but we'll get through it. But the how would we ever reconcile? There's a law in the North Dakota books that says that we cannot consider potential costs in a model. So there's a law out there that says that you can't consider cost per ton of CO2 in any kind of decisions that we would make. And so we're here today, and you're telling us that coal is the least cost alternative, so we'll sort through that. But we've got ourselves in a pinch here. If you're modeling all these things and all of a sudden a model pops up that doesn't show coal, but you've modeled a cost for carbon that's not there, we get ourselves wrapped around in a hurry on that.
They're referring to the externalities statute, and you know, I think we've talked about that. We talked about it a little bit in Big Stone, and Ms. Stomberg testified to that. Notwithstanding the statute, for your consideration, you know, for Andra and Alan and Brian's purposes, we can't ignore those possibilities in making our decisions. So we take them into account just to see how does it affect the decisions that we're making. You know, I think from an ADP standpoint, if we got into one of those scenarios, that we were picking a generation resource based upon the assumption that we were going to have a $30 or $50 carbon tax, and that's why we're going that route, I think we'd have to take a look at it. But ultimately, it's still the company's decision, you know, how that would fit into what the commission's determination and saying, and from an ADP standpoint, saying, yes, we agree with you that this is prudent in light of that particular possibility. I think that would still fall within your discretion. But fortunately, we haven't had to get to that scenario yet.
You wanted feedback.
We appreciate.
Things don't have to be deemed the most prudent. They just have to be deemed prudent.
They have to be prudent. Right. They don't have to be the least cost either. I think Correct. We've argued that. They have to be prudent. I mean,
we've dealt with that decision here before, but I think we all need to be careful as we model things and we come back at some point in time that there'll be a whole different viewpoint in this case if you were trying to convince me personally on something else is better because you'd model some costs out there that weren't in law.
If we were modeling a hypothetical $50 cost and saying as a result of that,
we're
picking something else, we've got a different question. I mean, there's no question. And that's kind of, why we want to, with these kind of times, 40 years ago, this wasn't an issue. I mean, you had coal, and you built coal, and you had some gas. Now we've got all these different options out there that we have to work through with. So
maybe that's something that the law should be tweaked, too. I mean, it's just a whole other kettle of fish, but I just opened that line of discussion for some time.
I think people have raised that possibility that maybe that law needs to be revisited.
Yeah, it'd be tough to defend for consumers. They'd expect that these things are being looked at and considered. Maybe it's not the driver, but you should be at least knowing what you're getting into.
And the 2019 time frame for the combined cycle, is the thought there basically that's about when growth combined with retiring of Lewis and Clark and retiring of Heskett, those three things together combine for enough demand to justify a 200-megawatt unit?
I guess that's kind of why we looked out to that 2020 time frame. That was when we thought possible the earliest EPA rules could come into effect that would affect Lewis and Clark and Heskett 1. So that's kind of why we did it to that point. And also it helped to meet that increase in demand, too, in the future with that extra. Plus it helps replace some of that baseload coal that we have now with that combined cycle unit going forward. I don't know if that answers it or.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent observation that you can start seeing through these results that at some point in time it's going to make sense for us to consider that larger combined cycle unit, and it'll, we'll be continuing to work. That will probably take a multitude of owners to put something like that together. So it's a way for us to visualize that that's going to possibly happen out there in the future, and we need to be holding hands with others to try to determine how we can get there.
It almost seems like based on the future demand requirements that we keep hearing about, that the time for that is now.
Well, I think, this is the model that Brian's doing is, it would have had the option, I believe, Brian, to have picked combined cycle in 2015 or 16 as yep. opposed to doing the baghouse. And it's saying, no, assuming under the current statute, even with a five-year life, you're better off doing the baghouse now and waiting with the combined cycle. Now, if we can run that baghouse for 7 years, this number, this 200-megawatt combined cycle, is going to shift down, or you may be building something smaller if you think you can run that bag house for 20 years. But, again, it's just our window with the environment that we're in is really pretty short to try to, plan for how much you can count on this particular facility. So that's why they use the 5 years, assuming that we can only run it for 5 years. Does it make sense to do this as opposed to just exactly what you're saying? Should we be looking at something bigger right now? And what the model is saying is not yet.
Do you think that's because this plant is so efficient? Or is it because the environment for choosing what that next fuel, what that next generation facility would be is so uncertain still that it makes sense to kind of have this temporary 5 years to use this facility and then see where we're at in terms of regulations.
I can answer, and I'll let Brian can either confirm or tell me I'm all wet. I think it's picking Lewis and Clark for a couple of reasons. Number one, you've got a fully depreciated plant that's already built as opposed to going out and building a new plant today with new capital costs. You're also using coal as a fuel that even with low gas natural gas prices today is still a very, very cost-effective fuel. So for those two reasons, as long as you can continue to run that plant, even with an addition of $27 million for a baghouse, that's 50 megawatts of generation that's going to be cheaper than 50 megawatts of new combined cycle generation. And I
absolutely.
Think that's probably...
Correct. Yep, exactly right.
Does this model take in any kind of consideration to partnerships with other utilities?
In a way, it does. Basically, we looked at it was a combined cycle of about 600 megawatts, but we knocked it down to 200 megawatts to put in the model, knowing that we'd have to go out to partner for that. We're not going to build a 600 megawatt on our own. So we did knock that down to 200, but with that same characteristics of a 600 megawatt combined cycle in the model.
That's the kind of the efficiency
exactly,
size
yep.
is about 600.
You're assuming a cost per megawatt based upon a 600 megawatt, even though you're only going to own 200 of it.
Yep.
That's what I was getting at and didn't probably phrase very well, but thank you.
One more while we're beating a dead horse again.
Well, the horse is okay.
I'm going down to Meridian, Mississippi to view that Kemper plant where they're capturing all the CO2 and they're the whole, it's the big Dewey project. Why don't you include a new coal plant where you capture the CO2 and make enhanced oil recovery in your 2020 model?
There, it did have an option of that. It okay. was, I don't have that, close to $6,000 a kW.
$6,000 per kW.
Yep.
Okay.
And that only included capture, no sequestration.
Yep.
So it's okay. about $6,000.
So that's just completely cost prohibitive. Even if you did that per gigawatt, it's still a lot.
Yeah.
Is that on this chart?
Yep.
$6,000 per kilowatt? Unbelievable. Okay. That answers that question.
Yeah.
But it does go back to the point, though, of Render's partnering that it may be a lot for electricity, but this plant that I'm going to tour down there, electricity is the byproduct. The oil companies are going after this CO2 and paying a lot for it. So they're going to take the CO2, get more oil out of the ground, so it would eventually offset that cost if you have a CO2, which is a commodity that you can sell. So I don't know how you would ever tie that into a model, but it's something that we should be looking at. And then it'll be interesting when I come back from that, but it's...
Well, probably the real value there is the development of the technology.
Sure, absolutely.
Hopefully the use of it in technology over time is going to have to take something like that to make it commercially feasible.
But you did look at it, though, so that's...
Yep.
That was my,
yep.
Thank you.
I'll tell you later.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then get into a few more of the sensitivities on the optimal resource case. This one's looking at a low growth and a high growth scenario. The low growth scenario has about 0.5% of growth of energy over the 20 years. And then the high growth has about a 4.4% energy growth per year over the 20 years. As you can see in the low growth scenario, it actually does not pick the Lewis and Clark Big House in 2015. And kind of the reasoning behind that is the low growth forecast. Our peak in 2012 was higher than the forecasted value in 2032. Our peak in 2012 was 573, and then the model for low growth forecast in 2032 was 545.
No.
So it's not really a liable case on that part, so.
God help us if that happens.
Yeah. And then just the high growth just shows additional of a lot of natural gas, almost 700 megawatts of natural gas over the 20-year period.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of into the last sensitivity that I have on the slides here. The first two we've already seen. The first one was just that retiring of Lewis and Clark. The middle one was the optimal resource case. And then the far right one is kind of what we talked about earlier on our current MISO resource adequacy requirements of only 80% coincident factor instead of that 90%. And even with that less of demand that we have to meet within MISO, it's still selecting that Lewis and Clark baghouse as the least cost plan. This is just kind of going in kind of to our five-year action plan. This was kind of what was laid out in our 2013 IRP. And it was to
Before you leave the model, can I ask a question about the model itself, the modeling? Yep. How widely used and respected is this, like the industry standard, this model that you're using?
It is.
To make all these decisions.
Yeah. In Michigan, all the companies in Michigan are required to run a GIS. The commission runs a GIS, and then they're actually starting. It's been about 10 years now since they've actually done any upgrades to this model. They're starting now here in 2013 to actually do upgrades and stuff to the model to kind of get it back up into production so more companies will use it.
Okay.
It's kind of been in a low here for the 10 years, but.
Are there alternative models to use, and why do you guys choose this one? Why do you have confidence in it?
I mean, we've looked at, it would have been about 6 years now, we've looked at other models. It kind of came down to cost-wise, and I mean, this model has been shown to prove what we've needed to do in the past, so there was no reason to go away from it. So
it's proved accurate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, and then just kind of the five-year action plan that we've laid out again was to proceed with the installation of the Lewis and Clark baghouse project, continue construction of Heskett 3, continue the installation of the Big Stone AQCS, continue to grow our demand response programs, continue to pursue that 50 to 100 megawatts of wind under a PPA, and then a couple more. Couple more was just for that short-term need, and that between now and that 2020 was to be able to either go out to the capacity market, MISO capacity market, or get capacity through another PPA like we currently have now to meet that kind of short-term capacity needs that we have instead of building all those internal combustion engines that were picked by the model.
So, good call.
Yeah. And then the last one was just potentially pursue that large combined cycle with a partnership.
I know we're getting long here, but I do want to ask you about your demand response programs, and you list them here as something that you tend to do more of. Can you talk a little bit about that, and how much did the company look at just trying to implement demand side management in dealing with this 50 megawatt need?
I'll try to answer the best I can. I mean, I'm not the best one to answer it, but it's more just kind of what we had modeled in the model was our external commercial and industrial demand response program that we have currently. We have about 3 megawatts, I think, last that I know of. It'd be just to continue to grow that. The model had it going to 10 megawatts. And then the other one was just that interruptible rate that MDU has to continue to grow that one, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think Darcy may have some comments, too, on that.
Oh, good. I'd love to hear it, Darcy.
We almost made it a whole. Grab a mic there, Darcy. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. This is Darcy Nigan with Montana Dakota Utilities. And just a little bit of information on our demand response programs and as far as what we're looking at. You know, historically, we've had some of our Rate 38 customers who were direct demand response customers, which would include the capital here. And so we're looking to continue to expand that through some of the new large industrial customers that are connecting onto our system. And either that would be through the usage of standby generators, or it would be an actual shutdown of their commercial process. An example of that would actually be the Matheson Air Separation Plant in Dickinson. Recently came online, and they end up being a new 4-megawatt demand response customer for us. So we're looking for more of those opportunities. One of the other places in the future that we're looking at for that type of demand response is the water treatment plant for the city of Williston. We've been in negotiations with them as well. That could be another 4 megawatts of demand response. And so we're looking for those opportunities and certainly trying to look at those large industrial loads or anybody that we really know that has standby generation. So there's a couple of the hospitals here in Bismarck that we've been in conversations with as well, and others like that. And the other program that we have was in our last integrated resource plan was a third-party aggregator of demand response programs. And that one we had hoped for a potential of up to 25 megawatts is where we were looking at. Today, I think we're sitting at about 7 megawatts that we've had enrolled in that program. We've been trying to find additional ways to expand that to get out and market that, particularly out in the Bakken area. We actually have one of the large industrial customers out there in the Tioga area for Air Liquide, another air separation plant, has come online in that program. And they're about a 3 to 4 megawatt customer load for demand response. One of the big things we picked up in that program here in the Bismarck-Mandan area was Bismarck Public Schools, because it's a great incentive for them as well to be able to participate and to be able to save some cost, at least on their energy bills that they have. Some of the other ones for the future we've talked about are certainly air-conditioned cycling programs and some of the like there, but we haven't gone to the place to try to roll anything out as far as residential air conditioner cycling yet.
Are you looking at any additional just residential incentive programs to encourage efficiency using the smart meters or, you know, how you're billing, that type of thing?
And that's some of the places, you know, of looking at a potential study that we completed as far as the integrated resource plan, as far as what potentially could be available out there for energy efficiency and demand response. That was particularly conducted out in Montana because there's a funding mechanism to pay for those programs. So in North Dakota, they're currently, those programs haven't been approved, at least by this commission, to be able to fund those sponsored programs that would be out to the residential customers. But that certainly is something that, you know, we're looking at potentials out in the future as well.
We have, just so MDU knows, Steffes Manufacturing asked to come in and talk to the commission. They're going to be here October 16th at 9 o'clock. And talking about just giving us an update about what their demand response programs are for their water heaters and their space heaters. And so I'm sure you folks have talked with them again, but if you got somebody to come by, that should be good to have your input on their presentation.
What was the date of that again?
October 16th at 9 a.m. We just scheduled that, I think, today maybe. So. Anything else, Jules?
No.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Darcy.
Okay.
Yeah, one more slide here just to kind of summarize kind of the results here. The modeling supports the installation of the Lewis and Clark Bakehouse project in all the sensitivity scenarios except for the low growth scenario, which we discussed that it wasn't really a liable case to run. The next would be the Lewis and Clark station with the Bakehouse project was determined to be the least cost alternative for Lewis and Clark versus the natural gas options or retiring it. And then the last is just, as kind of been iterated before, was that Lewis and Clark continues to be a vital resource in Montana Dakota's least cost resource plan in meeting the and serving the load needs in the Bakken area. That would be conclude mine.
Okay. Anything else?
That completes our presentation.
Would you offer all this up?
Offer all this up in support of our application. We appreciate it. I know this has taken a lot of time, but I think for all the reasons of the questions that you asked today kind of indicates why we want, you know, the commission to know what we're doing here and be comfortable with what we're doing here and your concurrence and our prudency of proceeding with the project.
We'll certainly receive your information. And I just said one thing. Now, Sarah gets to, we'll ask Sarah a couple of thoughts, too, here before we're done. So we're not quite done yet. But the appreciate the company's work. I just had a comment about IRPs. We've had a lot of discussion in the commission about IRPs. Companies file their IRP, and we don't do anything with them. And that's by design because we don't want to bless them. We don't want to say yes or no because that's a whole bunch of things included. So when you file something with the IRP, at least in the past, has been, your IRP, it doesn't mean that we're agreeing with it. It just means we're taking notice of it, and then we'll agree with it in each little step, let's say, per se.
But and I think this is exactly one of those steps in that IRP, that, you know, the IRP is a picture of what we're looking at. Now we're bringing to you a specific project consistent with that IRP. So.
Sure. Okay, any other questions for the company? Commissioner?
I do, yes. Brian, in the various pages of your modeling, I mean, these things came out with a lot of different results for different scenarios. It said for one thing is always there, and that's 2015, 50 megawatts of wind power purchase agreement.
Yep.
So it would almost appear to me like that's an input of the model, not the result that the model came up with.
It was actually in there as an alternative resource. We're working with a few different companies right now to try to finalize a PPA, wind PPA for that, and the prices that we've been offered are so competitive that it's a least cost option in all those scenarios with that cost of wind that's out there right now. So,
okay, and then I don't know who this would be for, but what's the status of the Savage Mine? Is that an MDU property? And do they have other customers? Is it going to be something that's going for a period of time?
I can answer that. The Savage Mine was sold to Westmoreland Corporation.
Recently, or long ago?
Many years ago.
Mid-'80s, probably?
Yeah, mid-'80s. I would consider it a going concern. It has two primary customers, Lewis and Clark and the Sydney Sugars. The reason I say I feel it's a going concern in that Westmoreland has felt enough confidence in our business and the Sydney Sugar business to reinvest in capital equipment for that mine in this over the last year. So they're really, and there's no other driving factor that would make it not a going concern if that goes.
That's it. Okay, it doesn't seem quite fair for the company, but now Sarah gets to go because you're much more prepared than they ever would be, right? Now, Sarah, just did you get a chance to review this? And just curious of your thoughts. You got all the companies, got 30 people in here, now we get Sarah. I have all my faith and trust and confidence there.
Fair enough.
fair enough for the company, right?
Well, I reviewed this and thought about other companies that have also had to do various pollution control actions to keep their plants running and facing similar situations where should we just keep – is it economical to just keep this plant running even for, say, in this case, 5 more years and put on these pollution control devices? And what we saw is Otter Tail doing a similar type action with Hoot Lake, where they know they're not going to run it forever, but they're installing additional pollution control on that plant as well, just to make sure that they can extend the life at a lower cost than, you know, the whole cost of building another generation resource. And I think we also compared it on a per megawatt basis to what's going on at Big Stone. And it's not necessarily, you know, a very good comparison, but it was on a dollar value still even comparable to that when you looked at a per megawatt basis price. And then Sargent & Lundy seems to do a lot of these studies. They did all the mercury control studies for NSP on their plants in Minnesota. So I also know that Sargent & Lundy is really well-respected as a firm to hire to do this type of analyses.
Okay, so is there anything that concerns that you'd have that hadn't been brought out yet that we should be aware of, or do you generally think this is a good idea?
Yes, I generally think it's a good idea.
All right. Okay, thank you, Sarah. Any questions for Sarah?
I have not.
Okay, so to close this up then, the company, will you want to submit a draft order, or Sarah, how would you like to close this out? Mr. Kuntz, it's your case.
I'm not sure what your typical process would be for an informal. I wouldn't think that you would have a formal order other than possibly approving a motion, approving the application, because there's, since it's not a formal proceeding, you wouldn't have, typically, I wouldn't expect findings of fact and so forth from that standpoint. So, okay.
Well, we'll just,
but we'll be, if you need something from us, let us know and we'll certainly try to accommodate.
I'd say give me, we talk to Sarah afterwards, and because then going forward, the sooner we get a draft to us, we can have a quick look at it and make it. We just had a meeting today, so we can maybe even have this 2 weeks for our next meetings. So, okay. Anything else for the good of the team? Commissioner? All right.
Good presentation, though.
Yeah, thank you all. We'll close the work session on case number, I'm sorry, the informal on case number PU 13-332. Thank you.
Do you guys do drive?
Someone has left the conference.
Technology?
Abby Krebsbach with MDU.
Someone has left the conference.